history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories that need to be heard. And if we take the time to ask a few questions and listen to the answers, we'll be amazed by what some folks have done for our country. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we go that way, as we take that journey, we learn a lot. We're educated, we're entertained, and often inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Today, we're going to talk to Billy Mills. Not the legendary runner, although maybe he's pretty fast too. He was definitely fortunate to survive World War II, and we're going to hear that story. Mr. Mills has lived in Modesto, California since before World War II, but you grew up in Wister, Oklahoma. How big of a place was Wister, Oklahoma?
Just a wide place in the road, you might say. A little country town, farm town.
Were you growing up on a farm?
Yes.
You and your brother?
Me and my brother.
You must have had some chores to do.
I did. A lot of chores to do.
Like what? Give us a taste of what life was like as a young boy.
You had to milk the cows, feed the chickens, just miscellaneous stuff.
Were you guys growing some crops there in Wister?
Oh, yeah.
What'd you have?
Oh, nothing spectacular. It was like a self-sufficient farm, in other words. We grew a little bit of cotton, and we grew corn, and we grew produce, garden stuff like carrots and tomatoes and what have you.
Uh-huh. How about okra? Did you grow any okra?
Oh, a lot of okra.
Mmm.
Yeah, that was her favorite.
You still have a taste for that?
Oh, yeah, I do.
Do you pickle your own?
I like it fried. I like it deep fried.
Deep fried is good. I like it every way, about.
Yeah, I do too. But if it's boiled or wet, well, you start to swallow, you don't change your mind.
It's gone. That's a good approach. So you're growing up on the farm in Oklahoma with your brother, milking cows and tending to all that. Do you remember while you're out there doing all those chores, thinking about, hey, someday when I grow up, this is what I'm going to do with my life? This is who I'm going to be?
No, not really. I was just enjoying being a kid.
Uh-huh. Until your family had to pick up and leave, like so many folks from that part of the country. What do you remember about that, how you guys ended up leaving Oklahoma and coming here to California?
Well, there wasn't any work. It was in the Depression time. Mm-hmm. Wasn't any work there. So father farmed. He worked timber, like cutting piling poles and stuff like that. Haul it to Panama, Arkansas. It might have been in Oklahoma, but anyway, it's close to Arkansas line.
Mm-hmm.
And just whatever, you know, to keep the wolf away. I had an uncle lived in Indio, California. He was farming there, so that's where we ended up. Joined him for a while.
You know, people hear about the Dust Bowl and the migration of people from Oklahoma out here to California, and, you know, a lot of folks picture what they've seen in the movies or on television, and a car of some kind loaded up with just about everything you can think of. Was that the reality for you?
That's just about it.
Did the car ever break down on the way out here from Oklahoma?
No, not really. My father, like I said, he cut logs for the sawmills and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Small sawmill, and he ended up hauling a sawmill for their owner to New Mexico. So that paid the way out, you know. We had the one truck, but he built a camper shell on it for his kids to ride in. So that's the way we ended up.
And I imagine you probably had no idea what to expect out here in California.
Well, not really. I was expecting vegetables and stuff like that because it was in contact with my uncle, you know. So that's what they grew in that area was produce mostly.
Yeah.
Dates, and they had the climate to grow corn, you know, the sweet corn, stuff like that. So.
Yeah. So you end up in Indio, and when did you move here to Modesto?
1940 or something like that.
Uh-huh. So you come to Modesto as a teenager. We're talking almost 80 years ago now. How different was this city? We've all seen that famous arch. What does it say? Water, wealth, contentment, health? That's the famous Modesto photo. Is that what greeted you when you got here?
That's right. And there was just a little village at that time. This was all country, out farm country here, mm-hmm. orchards and what have you.
Yeah, now it's a big city.
Now it's a big city.
So you went to Modesto High School. Were you playing any sports or anything in school, or are you too busy working?
Too busy working.
What kind of work were you doing?
Farm work, picking peaches, pruning peach trees, whatever came along.
And you were still in high school when the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor. Do you remember how you heard about that?
No, not exactly.
Well, you would end up serving on a ship that had quite a story on December 7th that was bombed by the Japanese on
right.
December 7th at Pearl Harbor.
Right.
But at that time, did you have any ideas of getting in the military at all, or how did that unfold?
Well, Uncle Sam sent me a notice saying I was needed, so I said, okay, Unc.
Yeah.
Then I ended up going to Farragut, Idaho for boot camp, and a month later I was back in San Francisco waiting for a ship.
Had you ever been at sea before?
No. All new.
What was it about the Navy?
Always the water, so, and I figured I'd have a clean bed. As long as I was floating, well, I'd have a place to sleep.
Yeah, and there would be a day where you weren't sure if you were going to keep floating. But
that's true.
At that point, you didn't know that. So you're in San Francisco waiting for a ship, and you didn't know what ship it was going to be.
No.
Did you have a preference? Were you hoping for a big ship versus a small ship?
Oh, I was hoping for a big one.
Tell us what you ended up on.
USS Curtis, seaplane tender, and flagship occasionally.
And some listeners might not be familiar with that type of ship. They know the carriers and the battleships and the cruisers and certainly the tin cans, the destroyers. So with that as a frame of reference, how big a ship is a seaplane tender? What's the whole point of your ship?
500 feet long or something like that, I'm not sure.
527 feet in length.
Yeah, I
know. That's what your official record says, yeah?
Five something.
You talk about a seaplane tender, so your point as a ship is to be out there in the theater supporting the seaplanes, the big PBYs and stuff like that.
Correct. And we had space for them to sleep aboard at times.
The crews from those seaplanes
from the planes,
had
yes.
bunks on your ship.
Right.
And maybe I got ahead of myself. I don't want to skip over your training up in Farragut, where so many World War II sailors came through and trained. Was there any part of that training that was particularly challenging for you or made you wonder what you got yourself into?
Didn't have time to wonder much. They ran us through so fast. We were really busy. Get us out the war.
So when you get aboard this seaplane tender, the Curtis, tell us what your job was on that ship and where you spent your time.
I spent my time in the boiler room. Started out as a fireman first, and then I ended up fireman second, petty officer second class.
And, you know, when people hear fireman, they think your job is to fight fires. Now, that would eventually happen in your case, ironically enough, but your job was to keep those boilers going, right?
That's
keep the
right.
ship moving?
That's right. That's actually the guts of the thing. If you don't have steam, you don't move on those ships.
Yeah, and that's got to be a pretty hot job.
It is hot. No doubt about it.
So take us inside the boiler room of a seaplane tender in World War II. How many boilers are going, and what do you have to do down there to keep them going?
They're oil-fired. We had two boiler rooms, forward and aft. I was in the aft. You had to keep the water in the boiler and the fire going in there without putting out smoke. In other words, oil and air, your air mixture, oxygen mixture, and at the same time keep from putting out black smoke. You heard from the captain if you put out smoke.
So you guys are constantly monitoring that.
Oh, yes.
That balance. And this steam power generated by those boilers is powering the entire ship and everything that's happening on the ship.
Right.
So that's a pretty important job.
Yeah, it is.
How many people were down there with you?
Let's see. When we were underway, there was four, I believe, each shift.
How long was a shift?
Normally 4 hours.
Uh-huh.
Like 8 to 12 and so on and so forth. Sometimes to keep from one person having the same shift where they had what they call dog the shift, you know, and one shift would work 2 hours longer and then the other one two less.
So they'd overlap?
Overlap.
Mm-hmm. So you'd go down there for 4 hours at a time and sweat your tail off because it's so stinking hot down there. I mean, it probably got, what do you think, 120 degrees hotter?
Oh, it probably was 120.
Yeah. Did you lose weight sweating it off?
No, not really. I wasn't very heavy to start with, so I couldn't afford to lose much.
Was doing that every day, is that something that became monotonous, or was there something that kept your attention or kept it interesting for you?
Oh, it was kind of interesting because we were moving from one island to another. We'd following up the task force, and we would have them dropping bombs around us every once in a while. Down the engine room, I'd sound like someone has a sledgehammer against the bulkhead, so that kind of keeps you awake.
Well, yeah, and that's got to be nerve-wracking because the guys on the deck, they can see the planes. They know what's happening. They know if it's close or not. You can't see anything.
Can't see anything.
And you'd probably have no warning that it's going to happen, right?
That's right. Of course, when you know they're dropping bombs nearby before you get the concussion, well, then you know it could happen any time. So.
But what can you do about it?
Nothing.
And if your ship got hit, you're probably not getting out of that boiler room.
Depends on where it gets hit.
Did you think about that? Did you think about, man, I could not see tomorrow?
Oh, I did at times, but I didn't worry about it that much. It's just one of those things you had to do, and had other guys with me doing the same thing. So grin and bear it, I figure.
I guess so. And I bet you got to know those other guys pretty well.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, all the engineering department I knew real well.
And I mentioned what your ship had been through at Pearl Harbor. And again, you're still in California. You're not in the Navy yet on December 7th, 1941. But I imagine you served with some guys who had been on the ship at Pearl. Did you hear some of their stories of what they'd gone through there?
Yeah, I did.
What did they tell you?
Oh, it's been so long, I don't know, but it was scary.
Because on December 7th, they had 32 men on the Curtis killed by a bomb, and a Japanese plane crashed onto the deck. The Curtis shot down four Japanese planes, also destroyed a Japanese submarine, and then, of course, was repaired there at Pearl. So that your ship had almost been sunk before you ever got on it.
Right, it did. Yeah.
And so then, as you said, here in 1943 now, you left the Bay Area July of 43, and you're out there, and most of the Pacific battles that everybody knows are still to come. You guys are out there in the Pacific when they take Tarawa, Kwajalein, and Eniwetok, Saipan, Guam, the Gilberts, the Marshalls, the Marianas.
There's a list of the islands.
Yeah, you've got a list here, and your ship would end up with seven battle stars. And so for all of the rest of 43 and 44 and 45, you're at sea that whole time.
We were out 18 months at one time without hitting our actual port.
Wow. I bet that got old.
It did get a little bit monotonous.
What are some of the things you remember about those days? You mentioned, you know, the bombs hitting nearby and everything. Were you aware of all the places you guys were and what was happening around you?
Yeah, we knew what was going on. And we, in between our steaming shifts, while we were doing repair work also, you know, so repairing pumps and cleaning the bilges. And so there wasn't that much spare time. They kept you pretty busy.
Uh-huh. Did you ever get a break? Did you ever get to go ashore anywhere for some R&R?
While we were out there, sometimes, ever so often, they'd load us on a boat and take us to some little island for swimming and a couple of beers.
Yeah.
Of course, there's no drinking allowed on the ship, so nice little break.
Probably didn't last long enough.
No, it didn't.
And what about the big picture of this war? Because all those battles, I mean, you've got your list right here from October of 43 through 1945, all the places you guys were. These are major battles where the Allies are emerging victorious at a heavy cost and advancing toward Japan. Were you aware of that progress? Were you aware of how many people were losing their lives?
I don't know if I really... I knew there was a lot of lives lost, but we didn't have that much news, you know.
And your job is seaplane tender, so these planes are coming in and going out, and you're interacting with those guys every once in a while, I bet. Mm-hmm. And you also mentioned something else, that your ship, the Curtis, at times served as a flagship.
Right.
That means you had the heavy brass on board.
Yeah, various admirals aboard at different times.
Did you ever get to see them? Were you around them? Were you nervous because they were on board?
No, I really didn't see them, you know, because my job was down below.
Uh-huh. Was that a little pressure to keep that boiler room in ship shape while the big boss was on board?
Oh, yeah. That's pretty much ship shape all the time because they expected the big shots in.
Flagship duties for Admiral McCain, father of John McCain, who we all know now, Vice Admiral Fitch and Hoover and Price. for different times, you had Admiral King, Admiral Nimitz, Admiral Halsey, and even two secretaries of the Navy, Frank Knox and James Forrestal.
Yeah, some of those were before my time, though, you know, but yeah. But it was a flagship, or it was equipped to be a flagship.
Yeah, those are pretty much all the biggest names in the Navy in World War II. Halsey, Nimitz, Knox, Forrestal. Yeah,
that's right. They fed good, though, for that reason.
When the Admiral's aboard, the food is pretty good. It's time for our first break. When we come back, we're going to hear about a tragic day on the USS Curtis, that seaplane tender that Bill Mills was on from 1943 until a year after World War II had ended. How did he experience the kamikaze attack that claimed the lives of dozens of his shipmates? And what heroic measures did it take to save that explosive-laden ship from sinking? You'll find photos of Bill and his ship at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, and we'll be right back after this. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say, I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank, it's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly a 250,000 EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 800 veterans have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328.
This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. Our guest today, Bill Mills, just celebrated his 93rd birthday in Modesto, California. He is originally from Wister, Oklahoma, but for 3 years in the 1940s, his home was the USS Curtis, a seaplane tender in the Pacific with a crew of roughly 1,200 men. Bill's job was in the boiler room way down below, so he never really interacted with the famous admirals who used the Curtis as a flagship from time to time. But he would experience plenty of excitement as the Curtis covered the Pacific to the tune of 7 battle stars. And we're going to get to a day that I know stands out in your memory, because that was the day your ship again, which had been hit on the first day of the war, your ship was hit again off of Okinawa in June of 45. But were there some days in those couple years before that, those 2 years you were on the ship before the kamikaze got you off of Okinawa, were there some close calls you remember or some things that stand out?
Oh, yeah. General quarters, working in my battle station was the boiler room, and maybe I'd have a GQ and it's secure, and I'd go up topside, and half an hour later you're back down again. And that was day and night.
Even if you're not on shift, you could be up topside, you could be taking a nap, but general quarter sounds and you've got to head down there.
Oh, yeah. Which reminds me one thing. On the deck, they had that big mushroom, which was an air intake.
Uh-huh.
Know, large.
Sure.
I was laying on top of that on off duty, I was laying on top of that with my legs hanging down. GQ sounded, and I jumped off running, and I didn't have any legs. I mean, they went to sleep, and I just flopped right out on the deck.
Oh, man.
I must have laid there working on my, rubbing my legs for 5 minutes before I could get up and walk.
Did anybody come by and wonder what was happening to you?
They were probably all too busy trying to get to their stations. So. I'll never forget that.
I don't know how you could. That must have hurt falling on your face, too.
It did.
And you can laugh about it now, but in those situations where general quarters sounded and you knew the enemy was in the area, was that tense? Was that nerve-wracking? Was that scary?
Well, you talk it serious. I mean, you got used to it, you know. That's another raid. Maybe they'll miss us again. So, But there was always, you know, they'd pick up bomber nearby. So most times, well, they were after the main fighting ships, you know.
Yeah.
more than us in the back. So
you guys were not usually the main target, but you could get caught in it.
Right.
And how frequent was this? How frequent were these situations where enemy planes are in the area and you're hearing bombs go off and all the anti-aircraft fire and you're down there in the boiler room wondering what's going on?
Well, it depends. Sometimes, you know, some islands, well, we'd sit in there for 2 or 3 days, you know, and nothing. And then maybe all of a sudden, why, you'd have 2 or 3 planes, 2 or 3 bombers coming over. And of course, they didn't take a chance. Well, you went to GQ and got ready for them. So.
Again, I want to get to the kamikaze deal, but any other memorable moments in those couple years until the kamikaze hit? Any funny things that happened or any trouble you got yourself into?
Oh, yeah. It's just routine, you know. That kind of gets to you after a while. That eat, sleep, and send your watch, and then sleep a little bit and do a little repair work.
Did you ever hear from home?
Yeah, I did. Not too often, but...
What was that like to hear your name called at mail call?
Oh, you look forward to that. Felt a little bit left out if you didn't have anything.
And was there something you would say that you missed the most about home when you're out there at sea for all that time? Did you ever get homesick for anything?
I don't remember especially getting homesick. A lot of the kids did, you know. Younger guys, they handled a little bit different, you know. I figured, well, it's going to end, so just do the best you can.
I'm sure you never had fried okra out there on the ship.
I didn't have any fried okra. I do remember one funny thing that happened when they had a supply ship come alongside, you know, where they'd organize a working party, you know, to carry the stuff in. So you had a lot of guys lined up, you know, right behind the other. Mm-hmm. That knew where the storage was. So we had a lot of apples. We came by the hatch going down into the boiler room where I worked, and I said, I'm going to get us some apples. I started down the ladder, and I got about halfway down. I looked up, and there was 2 more guys following me with apples. And I said, hey, get out of here. You're going to get me in trouble.
They were following your lead,
They
huh?
followed me because they're following the leader, you know.
Uh-huh. But you were taking a detour, and they took it with you.
Yeah, well, they didn't know the area, you know. So,
so how many apples did you end up with down there?
We just ended up with what I brought, yeah. Uh-huh. But I caught them in time. Otherwise, I'd had that boiler room full of apples. We had a hot plate and stuff down there, so we kept snack stuff, you know, where we could eat if we wanted to in our spare time. So.
Well, you could probably just set it next to that boiler for a second. It would... Heat up in a hurry.
It would, yeah.
All this time that you're out there, was there anything that ever gave you a real sense of the cost of war or how much this was a life and death situation? Were you ever confronted with the loss of other sailors or ships?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's what kept you going, really, thinking about that. So,
did you see some other ships get hit?
No, I didn't.
Since you were down below.
Since
huh?
I was down below.
Yeah.
And primarily, the ones that were getting hit were a little ways away from us anyway, because we didn't want to risk the Admiral.
Sure. And before you guys were hit by a kamikaze on June 21st of 1945, were you aware of this kamikaze phenomenon? Had you heard about this?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we were thinking about those all the time. We knew we were going into that area, too, when we went, so that was getting pretty close to Tokyo, or Japan, rather.
Well, and this is where kamikazes were the thickest and the most active was off of Okinawa.
Right.
So you guys know when you're headed that way that this is a possibility.
Yeah.
And again, you're not going to see it coming. You're not going to know what's going on.
No.
Well, tell me about it. June 21st, 1945. What do you remember about that day?
The main thing I remember, I guess, that we were in general quarters most of the time. You know, it might let up for just a short time and finally go up on the deck. Finally, I tuck a blanket down and just sleep on that diamond plate steel rather than try to go back up the ladder and back down again. So, about 2 or 3 days there around that time where we were in general quarters most of the time.
So the days leading up to June 21st, you knew kamikazes were in the area.
Right.
And you're just pretty much on nonstop.
You're right.
So you must have been pretty tired. Must have been worn out.
Yeah, I made a note there one place that I kept a little ledger on it. But I made a note there one time I slept an hour and a half.
Let's see if I can read your writing. June 21, 1945, in port at 1842, that's 6:42 p.m., got hit
I can't read it either. So.
Well, it hit by Japanese dive bomber. NGQ most of night, except for a few minutes at a time. Captain Peck was relieved by Captain Doan.
About two hours and something before.
Yeah, 2 hours and 42 minutes before the ship was hit.
Right. So he was off to a bad start.
So this was the captain of your ship?
Yeah. He had just changed captains just before we got hit.
Well, I'm sure there's a lot more to this story than what I just read, that at 6:42 p.m. you got hit by a Japanese dive bomber. Where were you when that happened?
I was in the engine room already because, like I say, we were at GQ most of the time, so I happened to be down there.
And what did that feel like down there when that plane hit?
It felt like the ship bounced off at the bottom and came back up like a cork or something, the way it felt. I knew we were hit.
Did it throw you off your feet?
Oh, yeah, it shook you up a little bit.
Uh-huh.
And then the ship started to list, naturally, you know. So as it would list, I'd pump water into, or fuel, whichever, into another tank on the other side, and I'd level it off. And about the time you got it level, all the water would shift, and you'd go back the other way. So it was kind of nip and tuck for a while.
Yeah, and probably a lot of people wouldn't even consider that that's how you deal with that situation. So you're in this boiler room. The ship's listing to one side, and if you don't do this right in moving the water around from tank to tank, your ship could sink.
Yeah, it just keeps listing, you know, if you don't pump water to a tank on the other side. So.
And had you ever practiced that before?
I hadn't had the occasion to do that.
How'd you know what to do?
I'm not sure. Somebody told me or I figured it out, one or the other.
Well, it's a good thing you did.
Yeah.
And is that just you doing that? Did you have some other guys helping you?
I had other guys down there, but I, you know, just one guy on the open valve. Well, I had someone to open the valve, you know, or close it.
And how long do you think you had to keep doing that before the ship straightened out?
Oh, it's been so long. It's been about 75 years, so. But it was quite a while. Then there was a seagoing tug came alongside and tied on, kind of propped us up, you know, and.
But those had to be some scary moments for you.
Well, they were scary.
Did you think you guys were going under?
No, I didn't think so. I mean, I didn't have time to think that we were or weren't.
Yeah.
I was just doing my job, you know, trying to figure out which way to pump that water.
And you had to go back and forth a few times, right? Because
right.
It was listing one
right.
way and then the other?
Right.
Yeah. That sounds tense enough to me.
Till we got the tug along, seagoing tug alongside, you know, and kind of stabilized us.
And was that night that the tug came along?
Yeah, within a few hours, the tug was there. It must have been close by. And there was another ship, too. They sent a crew aboard to weld a border plate over the hole where there's about a 5x8 gap in the hole, I think.
Well, this is what the Navy said a couple months later when they finally told everybody what happened to you. They said the seaplane tender USS Curtis's fighting power survived at almost maximum strength the crash of a Japanese suicide plane and its 1,000-pound bomb last June near Okinawa, although 35 men were killed and 21 wounded. The kamikaze's delayed-action bomb rammed through to the center line of the Curtis before exploding immediately over a bomb stowage magazine, which miraculously escaped detonation.
That's the part that... Where somebody is looking out for us.
I guess so. How is that possible?
I don't know. It don't sound possible to me.
So
but it happened.
Where this bomb went off was right next to bombs that you guys were carrying.
Yeah.
But somehow they didn't go off.
Somehow they didn't.
Whew.
Yeah, I think the good Lord was looking out for us.
Hard to argue with that.
Yeah.
Is that something you believed at the time? That you thought the good Lord would be looking out for you? Or is that just something you see in retrospect?
Yeah, just something I see in retrospect.
Uh-huh. So the bomb hits. Somehow it doesn't set off the bombs on your ship, but it does kill more than 35 men. I think later they said 37?
Yeah, something like that. Obviously, you heard two or three different counts, uh-huh. But somewhere around 35.
Were there guys that you knew that were killed that day?
I didn't know them too well because it was out of the engineering department.
Uh-huh. If your ship had gone under, do you think there's any way you would have survived?
It's hard to know.
Given where you were, you're kind of trapped, aren't you?
Yeah. Yeah, kind of trapped if it comes in above.
So you're in there in the boiler room, pumping it back and forth to keep the ship afloat. At what point did you realize the extent of the damage that had happened up above?
Oh, I didn't know for a while, you know, because I was still in general quarters. So it was later that they announced that we were secure, you know. So
then what did you have to do?
Stop shaking, I guess.
Well, I'm sure you had a job with relation to cleaning up the damage.
Oh, yeah.
Right? What'd you have to do?
Wasn't much damage in where I was in the boiler room.
Right.
It hit the sick bay and different area in the bomb storage, but it didn't really do any damage where I was except shake you up a little bit. So just a little cleanup, you know.
But I can't imagine that was an easy job.
No, it wasn't an easy job.
You probably saw things that you'd never seen before.
Oh, I did, yeah. So anyway, we survived.
Yeah. But you probably saw a lot of guys who didn't survive. Like, you probably saw what was left of them.
Right. Yeah. It's not a pretty sight. I guess that's why I filed these papers away in the closet and I didn't even think about that was another life, you know.
You really haven't talked about it these last 70 years.
Not too much, no. If somebody asks me, well, I'll tell them.
Did you tell your kids about it growing up?
Not very much till they were grown.
Well, this gives a little more description of it from this official Navy record. It says the Curtiss was operating in the southern Ryukyu's Islands near Okinawa when the kamikaze struck at dusk of June 21, 1945. The Japanese plane took advantage of the gathering darkness and concealment of neighboring islands to approach within 800 yards before he was sighted by lookouts aboard the Curtiss. The plane struck on the starboard side amidships at an estimated speed of 400 knots. The engine, part of the tail assembly, and the heavy bomb ripped through the skin of the ship, opening two gaping holes and exploding on the third deck. The terrific explosion wiped out the sick bay spaces, together with the warrant officer's mess room, staterooms, officer's galley, library, photo lab, barber shop, and post office. Choking smoke gushed from the damaged area, and flames licked through four decks above the point of the explosion. Fire mains and sprinkler systems in the blasted area were ruptured, and the firefighting crew brought emergency extinguishing equipment to bear. At this critical stage, however, the main propulsion engines were operative, and the Curtiss could have proceeded at moderate speed. Also, gun crews standing at general quarters stations against further air attack, and all guns operative except the forward 5-inch battery. With the fires out of control, there was imminent danger of the flames reaching the bomb stowage magazine, the upper ammunition handling rooms, and adjacent magazines. During this critical period, many acts of individual heroism were observed. When it became apparent that a great volume of water was needed to control fires in the Curtiss, two salvage vessels and two ocean tugs came alongside to assist. These small ships, under grave danger from threatened explosion of the Curtiss's magazine, remained alongside for more than an hour, pumping heavy streams of water onto the burning compartments. The Shackle sent a combat fire team aboard the Curtiss to cut their way with torches into a compartment in which a dangerous fire was burning. With flames under control, the ship's force turned to, with little rest, to clear away the debris and pump out flooded magazines and compartments. Then a service force repair crew came aboard to weld a boilerplate on the 5-by-8-foot gash in the hull. The ship was prepared to proceed. In reporting the action, the commanding officer credited the cool efficiency of the entire ship's company in the face of great danger with saving the ship and reducing casualties to a minimum. Sounds like a pretty big deal.
Yeah, it was a big deal to me.
Absolutely, because your life was at stake. It's time for another break. Don't forget you can find photos of Mr. Mills then and now at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, where you'll also see a video of Bill showing us the well-preserved pocket-sized log that he kept during World War II. If you flip to June 21st, 1945, you'll see his brief entry on that long and harrowing evening that came close to claiming his life as well as so many of his shipmates. We'll hear more of his memories from that, as well as his recent adventure on an honor flight to Washington, D.C., when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. You hear a lot about World War II if you listen to Hometown Heroes, but have you ever wondered what it's like to be on a real World War II ship? The SS Jeremiah O'Brien, one of just two remaining operable Liberty ships, is docked at Pier 45 in San Francisco's famous Fisherman's Wharf. And the O'Brien is offering overnight programs on Fridays and Saturdays for kids ages 6 and up. Kids get to sleep on the ship in World War II bunks, have a private tour of the ship's galley, the crew quarters, guns and gun mounts, exhibits, and the crown jewel, the O'Brien's triple expansion steam engine. This is an experience like no other. For more details, call the SS Jeremiah O'Brien's office at 415-544-0100. That's 415-544-0100. Or visit the ship's website at ssjeremiahobrien.org.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit with 93-year-old Bill Mills of Modesto, California, originally from Worcester, Oklahoma, and a Navy veteran of World War II. We heard about Bill's ship, the seaplane tender USS Curtis, being struck by a Japanese kamikaze off of Okinawa in June 1945. 35 of his shipmates were killed, quite a few more wounded, but it could have been much, much worse. Somehow, the bomb stowed below deck barely avoided being detonated. Stores of ammunition weren't set off either. And as Bill was down below, shifting fluid from one side to the other in the boiler room to help keep the ship afloat, four other ships came to the Curtis's rescue to fight the fire covering parts of four decks. These other ships, by coming to your aid, were risking themselves. All those guys were risking their own lives.
Right. Because we could have had an explosion in there any time, you know, and they were gone too, so.
Yeah, not only was it miraculous that the Japanese bomb didn't set off your bombs, but these fires are still burning. They could set off all kinds of stuff.
Right, that's what it'd be.
And where that Japanese plane, where the damage stopped, was four decks down. Are you right below that?
Yeah, I guess I was just below it. I was at the bottom point, really. Just the bilges all was left underneath me, so.
So if it had come down a little further, it blows you and everything up.
Yeah, it would.
And this fire's going for a while. Did you see any of that fire or the smoke?
No, I didn't. Like I say, I was in my battle station in the boiler room. I am glad I didn't see it.
And your commanding officer credits the whole ship with saving the ship. That means you. What you were doing down there in the boiler room helped save the ship.
Yeah, I suppose.
I think that's a pretty big deal. So for the last 72 years, this is something that happened in your life that came close in a number of ways to ending your life. That's fair to say, right?
It is.
How often have you thought about that over all these years?
Not too much. I mean, I figured, well, I made it, so why worry about it now?
You came home, you got married, you had a couple kids, now you have grandkids, great-grandkids. You worked 39 years for a cold storage company. Was that because you're tired of the heat down in the boiler room, or what?
You know, when everybody got discharged at that time, while you worked at whatever you could find, I was lucky that I could find a steady job, because a lot of people couldn't. So I found this little refrigeration plant that, when it started out, well, it was a ice plant. They were making these 300-pound blocks of ice. There's reefer cars that they ship fruit
on the railroad,
On the railroad. That's before they had the refrigerated cars.
Yeah.
So it was an ice bunker on each end, and they'd run these 300-pound blocks of ice up there and put them down in this thing. And then this same company built a warehouse, a cold storage warehouse, and so I just grew along with them.
So what did you prefer, 120 degrees in the boiler room or shivering in the cold storage?
I'll take the cold storage.
Nobody's shooting at you there, huh?
Yeah, right. And you can dress a little heavier.
I guess so. Well, and like I say, so none of that, all those memories you have from that long career, your kids and grandkids and great-grandkids, you never even would have met your wife if things had gone a little differently on June 21st of 1945. How do you explain that? What do you make of that?
That's life, I guess. Some people weren't so lucky, so a lot of people died.
You know, the war wasn't over the next day. You guys have all these ships come to your aid. They help you out. You got another 2 months before the war ends.
Yeah.
Was it different after that? Were you more anxious or nervous because of what had happened?
No, not really. After we got underway, you know, got patched up, we went to Guam and, And they went dry dock for a few days, and we got to go to rest camps for 3 or 4 days. Then we limped back to the States, and Mare Island, and they did a repair job, and we were back out. I think we're in the States 2 months, I believe.
Yeah, the war ends, and you end up having to go back out there, all the way to China.
Right.
But what about the end of the war? Did you have a chance to celebrate VJ Day and the fact that this enemy that almost took your life had now surrendered?
Oh, yeah. I could start to enjoy it a little bit and enjoy the different places I'd see.
Yeah, what did you guys see after the war was over and you went back out to sea? What are some of the things you remember?
Oh, I remember Shanghai especially. At Christmas time, in 45, we were in Shanghai, China.
Uh-huh.
Going ashore there and these rickshaw boys fighting over which one's going to get the fare. Got to haul you around.
Uh-huh.
All these little kids running around begging, you know, and stuff like that. So I was anxious at that time to get out. I think we went to Shanghai 2 different times. The second time we went there, I transferred to another ship, a merchant marine ship, the Phoenix, then shipped into Seattle.
Tell me how you met your wife.
With a couple of 3 buddies, I was in the park on a Sunday, I guess it was, having a beer, and my wife and her girlfriend drove up, and of course I had to go up and say hi, and that's where it started.
What was it that made you go up and say hi, or did you just do that to every girl that came around?
Looked friendly or something, I don't know. It looked like she wouldn't throw rocks at me or something.
Is there anything about your time in the Navy that I haven't asked you about that you think is important for people to know?
I would have enjoyed it under different circumstances. In other words, the last cruise out, why, that was an adventure. One thing I regret, my ship went into Tokyo Harbor. I rated Liberty and I could have gone ashore, but I didn't want to. I regret it now. I didn't want to see them. I didn't want to face them or something.
So in retrospect, you wish you would have gone off and looked around a little bit?
Because I've never been to Japan.
Why was it you were so upset with Japan? Was it just that they had started this in the first place or that they had hit your ship?
Or? I think so. And all the buddies that had died, you know, and all that stuff. So I didn't have a good feeling for them. I was finished.
And when you got out of the Navy and you came back and you went to work, was it hard to make that adjustment from being on a ship with a bunch of greasy guys all the time to living in this real world in California?
Yeah, a little bit. Had to watch your language a little bit because you've been there with only 3 years with the guys, you know. It was different. For a while, you kind of have to learn how to walk again because you're waiting for the ship to roll.
Find yourself tripping on level ground?
Right.
Well, as long as your feet don't fall asleep when you jump off the mushroom van.
Right. Huh?
How about the weather? Did you guys ever have to sail through a typhoon or anything like that?
We had the warnings sometimes. We'd be on auxiliary boiler and we'd have to fire up and get ready just in case it hit us. But on the way home on the Phoenix troop ship, we missed the typhoon, but we got the big swell. So we got some pretty rough water there.
Were you down below while that was going on?
No, I wasn't down below. I was looking at the giant waves. There was Chinese cadets on their way to Seattle, and every one of those poor guys were just sick as a dog, you know, because I guess they probably hadn't been on a ship before because they were aviation cadets, so broke them in.
How about any run-ins with famous names during World War II?
I saw Bob Hope show a time or two. In fact, I think Bob Hope and some of his party stayed overnight on our ship one time. Anyway, we went ashore for his show.
I bet that was a big crowd.
It was a big crowd.
That's when the Navy and the Army and the Marines all get along?
Right.
And what did that do for you? To get away from all these constant general quarters to sitting there and laughing at Bob Hope and these folks who are risking their lives by being out there.
Oh, yeah, that was something. I mean, that like gave you a fresh start, something else to think about.
The other name I've got to ask you about, Tokyo Rose.
Oh, we heard Tokyo Rose quite a bit.
What kind of stuff did she say?
Oh, she's just telling you what all you should do and what they were going to do to you and all that kind of stuff. I don't remember she ever said Curtis or not, but probably so, because she was picking out different ships at times. So.
Uh-huh. Was that something that spooked you or made you laugh or what?
Oh, I guess you just kind of laughed at it because you knew what it was. We had an old salt. He is a boilermaker. Was his rating, and he had his own compartment where he stored all of his parts. In fact, he even slept in there sometimes. A funny thing happened there. He didn't allow gambling, you know, on the ship, but he could close the hatch and nobody knew we were in there. So we'd go in there and gamble and do a little bit of drinking. I mean, he had a still in there too. He's distilling torpedo juice. So never got caught. I thought we were one time. There was a crawl through window type thing, you know, besides the main hatch.
Uh-huh.
Somebody knocked on this, you know, and the boilermaker, he got up and cracked it open, and there was an officer's hat. And I said, uh-oh, we've had it. Come to find out, why, he is a buddy of this.
He was coming to get in on the action?
Right. Yeah. In fact, he did. He came in and played with us. Kind of threw you for a minute when you saw that, because I didn't know about it.
Uh-huh.
I didn't know he had an officer involved.
And you said earlier that, you know, for decades, you really didn't think about this, didn't talk about it. But you had an experience recently that I imagine brought some of that coming back. When you went with a bunch of other veterans from here in California to Washington, D.C. with Central Valley Honor Flight to visit the World War II Memorial and other spots. Tell me about that trip. What stood out for you?
Well, I thought it was great, but I just feel like I was being treated as a hero, and I wasn't a hero. You know, I just did my job.
Well, if you hadn't done your job as well as you did it, there might have been more guys who didn't come home.
Yeah, that's another way to look at it.
Including you.
including me.
What were the things about that trip, the things that happened on that trip, that made you feel that way, that they were seeing you in that light?
Everything, I guess. I mean, there was someone waiting on you, taking care of you. You didn't have to. And then a lot of these places I would have never seen, you know. So I really appreciate it.
You had a few people that wanted to shake your hand?
My hand hasn't rested up yet.
What do they say to you?
Most of them say thanks, you know, and stuff like that. When they came back into Fresno, there's some of those ladies were even crying, you know, as they had tears in their eyes as they'd shake your hand. So I thought that was something.
I bet they did more than shake your hand. I bet you got a few kisses on the cheeks.
I did. That was a highlight.
And I bet you had a whole lot of your family waiting for you.
Yep, that's for sure. That was great.
And the band playing and people waving red, white, and blue and
right.
Cheering for you.
Yeah, and the way the traffic gave you the right-of-way on the buses and stuff like that, that was amazing.
You know, I've had a lot of veterans tell me that. One of the things they're most impressed by was having a police escort around Washington, D.C.
Yeah, that impressed me, for sure.
Make you feel like you're somebody.
Right. Maybe I am a hero.
I think there's a lot of people that would say that. And I asked you earlier about getting mail from home. Did you get some mail on that flight? Did they hand you some letters on the way home?
Oh, yeah, that was something. Wasn't those kids? That brought tears to my eyes, you know, that they'd go to all that trouble.
People you've never met before are writing you letters and saying
right. Thank
you.
Mm-hmm.
And what about being there in Washington? I know you saw a lot of things. You saw the changing of the guard at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier, and you saw all the names on the Vietnam Veterans Memorial Wall, the haunting Korean War Memorial, and those soldiers marching through the rice paddy. But what about being at the World War II Memorial and taking all that in? Here you've got a pillar for Oklahoma, your native state, and one for California, the state that you've lived in for all these years. And then there's that wall of gold stars. 406,000 Americans were killed in World War II. What did you think about while you were looking at that?
I was just thinking it was a big waste, and hope we don't have to do it again.
Did the thought enter your mind how close you came to being part of one of those stars?
No, not really. I guess I figured I made it, so why worry about it now or something?
And I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I'm just curious, too, if while looking at that big wall of gold stars, and it says underneath, here we mark the price of freedom. Did your mind go to any of the people you knew who died in World War II?
Just the crew, mostly, my ship.
Yeah, 36 guys who were killed with that kamikaze.
Yeah, and the Pearl Harbor, too. I mean, the Pearl Harbor, that bothers me, the Pearl Harbor.
Because it was a surprise attack?
Yeah.
You remember feeling that before you went in the service?
Yeah, I was ready to go back and pay for it.
I know it was a long way away at the opposite end of the war, but the way the Curtis was hit on December 7th was very similar to the way it was hit on June 21st, 1945. A Japanese plane with a bomb crashing into the ship.
That's right.
And who knows how close you were to being entombed in the boiler room of the Curtis.
Oh, yeah. Or he could have hit by the boiler room, so.
You would have never known what hit you.
I'd never known.
Well, I don't want to belabor that point, but I do want to join all those people who shook your hand on the honor flight and said, thank you for serving our country. Thank you also for telling us a little bit about it. Is there something that you'd say, you know, most of us alive today weren't alive during World War II. We didn't hear about Pearl Harbor on the radio. We didn't go through rationing. We certainly didn't go overseas and get shot at or get kamikazed off of Okinawa. What do you think is important for us to understand today about what happened then and what all you guys went through and why you did what you did?
Just hope it don't happen again, I guess.
Do you think America was different then than it is now?
Oh, I think so. I don't think America would do that now. I don't think they'd come together like they did in World War II. People are too divided in opinions.
You said something a little while ago. Who do you see as the heroes of World War II?
Actually, I see the heroes as the guys that are out there in front with the Marines and the attacks. That's the heroes. That's where you're going in face to face with these guys. To me, they're heroes.
Last question I have, unless there's other things that you want to say. What would you say you're most proud of?
Most proud that I went through and did my part. I've always been a hard worker, you know, and had a job to do, but I did it. So there was some kids on there that would fight the system, you know, and they had it rough. I figured, well, you go along with it and do the best you can.
I'm sure we can all find the occasion to follow Bill's example in that regard. Bill Mills, now 93 years old, of Modesto, California. Don't forget to see that video of his World War II log or the photos of Bill at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And join us again next time as we're reminded once more through the stories of our veterans that freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive, and then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that honor flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. Gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.